What's the date? Monday, July
23rd.
I think tomorrow's the 22nd, right?
No, today's the 22nd.
Oh, 20th.
Monday, July 23rd. LA Podcast, Scott Frazier, Alyssa Walker. You're just here now.
I'm just here.
Hey,
what are you gonna
it's
do?
Not I, the bloom is off. It's not like a special thing anymore. You're just part of the furniture. This week was very bad, especially yesterday. A lot of bad things happened, but we have some good news and fun stuff to talk about this week as well to keep it light. We'll like figure out as we're talking.
Less depressing than it would otherwise be.
A story we wanted to start with, that this was national news. Everyone who's listening to this will have heard about it by now, but there was a shooting at Trader Joe's in Silver Lake on Saturday. A man was chased by police from South LA after shooting his grandmother and another woman. The chase ended on Hyperion Avenue in Silver Lake. He ran into a Trader Joe's. There was a shootout, and a store manager was killed, and her name was Melita Corrado. Well, this was awful. This was like my neighborhood store. We've all been to this store many times. It's a lot of very nice people who work there. They all seem to get along really well.
It is in many ways a very central part of the Silver Lake neighborhood.
Yeah.
That I feel like just like everybody who lives in this part of town goes to like pretty frequently.
Yeah.
So
I saw some, I wish I could remember who, but someone compared it to like the Bodega in New York. It is like the neighborhood place where you just kind of go get everything.
And a lot of people who have worked there for like decades.
Yeah.
You know, there are like fixtures in the community that you know and recognize outside of the store.
Yeah. One thing, we're waiting for details to come in about exactly what happened still. There were lots of LAPD people there who were extremely heroic. I saw video of officers carrying children and animals to safety. And they managed to, after the initial shootout, to defuse the situation without any further injury, which was impressive. I do think it's worth discussing. Yesterday, LAPD confirmed to the LA Times in their article about this that the gunman had been the person who shot Melita Corrado. That was in the print edition today. That was the article that they published.
Yep.
Today, they walked that back. And they said that they didn't know exactly who had done it. I read the initial statement that they said it was the gunman. I wasn't sure how they were certain about that, because what it seemed like happened, according to a lot of witnesses, is that multiple officers shot into the store.
Yeah, so the chain of events was essentially the pursuit ended with the gunman crashing into a pylon outside of the store.
Yeah.
There was gunfire exchanged between the gunman and police. He ran into the store, at which point he was holding like 40 or so people hostage near the checkout area. So it sounds like now they don't know who in the crossfire hit Melita Corrado. Is that right?
Yeah. I talked to a witness, the guy named Devin Field, who he was on Twitter talking about exactly what happened. He was with three officers during he was walking into the store when the gunman ran in. So he was there for the initial firefight. He was crouching behind a concrete wall, and he was next to three officers who were firing in the direction of the store. And that was the shootout during which Melita Corrado was killed. She was a store manager. Her station is right next to the door. And witnesses said that that officers did shoot out the windows of the store. This is a really intense situation. It's not really for, I think, any of us to say like what an officer should do in that moment. I'm sure they were thinking the person could go in there and cause more damage. The only thing that I do think is important is that we know what happened. It's a little concerning to me that they would come out with an initial statement that said that they knew what happened when it turned out they didn't. And it just makes me wonder when exactly we'll find out what went down.
There was also a lot of confusion from even people who were there and who were interviewed by the local news, because they were under the impression that everybody was fine, that nobody had gotten hurt. So there was like the timeline, which is, it always happens when there's breaking news like this or situations where it's kind of dynamic. But it was strange too to see that they basically had cleared the area, said that it was a peaceful, you know, resolution, everything was fine, and then all of a sudden a report that somebody had not just died but was dead on arrival.
Yes.
When, you know, and you could look, and the choppers had these like shots of this, you know, the triage mat set up where they were bringing people out, and there was no, you couldn't even see any of that activity. So it was all very strange to watch live, as we all were watching from our houses. And nobody really seemed to know what was going on. So of course there'll probably be camera footage, security camera footage, would you think, of the store?
Yeah, I mean, and with like ballistics and stuff, I think they can figure out exactly what happened.
Right.
But I think for the future, for their policy in these situations, there has to be a way to avoid shooting into a grocery store full of people.
I mean, I would go even further than that personally. I think as somebody who did not grow up in the culture of Southern California, I've always thought that the deeply ingrained like police pursuit thing was baffling to me, because it does potentially endanger so many people's lives. I don't understand it from a law enforcement perspective. I get that you want to like contain a situation, but like for instance in this case, I think the potential for the violence to spill over into a very public area is high, and so I don't necessarily know that I think they should have been doing this in the first place.
I mean, even as chases go, it was a particularly intense chase, because he was firing while he was driving, and apparently there were like casings all down whichever way he came, Hyperion, Rowena, I'm not sure.
Yeah.
But there was, you know, I always get worried in these kind of situations, anytime there's chases, because I worry about obviously car crashes and people getting hit, and somebody could have very well been killed just by the car crashing into whatever it crashed into outside of the store. But I mean, you have to wonder at what point, it surely felt like there were as many opportunities to intervene. I mean, how could you have driven as far from South LA to Silver Lake? That's what I just can't understand. They had trouble locating the vehicle, I guess, and they finally used technology, like LoJack technology, they kept saying. Yeah.
But the chase itself, I think, was an hour and a half.
Yeah. Like, how could it have gone on even that long all the way to Silver Lake? To me,
I'm willing to believe that to reduce the, like, potential for other people getting injured, that they don't want to like run the car off the road or do anything like that. So that could be why it took so long. It ended when the driver ran it. Well, was running into another group of officers that were cutting him off.
Right.
Now, was that the place to do that? That's a crowded shopping center. I think strategically that was maybe not the smartest idea. But again, this was someone who had just shot two people. Yep. It wasn't, the initial reports were that it was a stolen car. And so then everyone, I think, was thinking like, well, just let him go. Yep. This did not have to happen. But this was someone who was armed and had shot people. So it was a very dangerous situation. And not all the LAPD officers involved did anything wrong. Some of them did really great things.
Yeah.
But I think it's worth figuring out what did go wrong.
And also first maybe big real event for our new our new leadership in the LAPD.
Yeah.
I don't know. Did you say
Michael?
Michael.
But you don't say Michelle. Even we went it's through. Spelled like we, this. Sorry. We I know. I know this. You did, but I still want to say it. So
it's Michael.
It's the first real test for our new LAPD leadership. And I will say also, since we talked last week about where the mayor was during the heat wave, the mayor was there on the site almost immediately. Perhaps because the president tweeted about this situation, then later deleted the tweet, I believe. I don't know how long it took him to delete
the tweet.
Yeah,
I wonder why that was. That was,
I think,
odd.
He was just watching Fox News and that was on, and then he, you know, but really like kind of like a very big moment to see the mayor there on the scene making a statement.
Yeah.
So that was good. I mean, you're right. Like all the things were really good. It was good that attention was paid to this and the response was fast. The employees also were supposed to be amazing in this situation. There was people helping victims climb out the back windows.
Yeah. And I saw them. I went to the scene. I saw them all kind of gathering, waiting for the others to get out. And it was awful to see them go through that. There's a big memorial set up if you're in the neighborhood. A lot of flowers put out. People are putting notes on the wall. I think that's a nice thing for the employees to see when they come back, when the store opens again. We want to talk about Ref Rodriguez, someone that we have talked about multiple times. Big news in that whole story. He is the LA USD School Board of Education District 5 member. That covers Los Feliz, Silver Lake in the north, that area. Then it expands in a weird little band south to like
Southeast LA.
Lynnwood, Huntington Park, Bell, Southgate. He has been in trouble for a variety of things over the last few months. One specifically was accusations that he had laundered funds, his own money, he had distributed to friends and had them donate it to his campaign so he didn't violate campaign finance law. He was charged with this crime. If he were convicted, it would lead to potentially jail time for him. The new development is that there are reports from Howard Bloom of the LA Times and Kyle Stokes at KPCC, the two guys that really cover this the most, that he is going to plead guilty. He's in the middle of a plea deal, and that will probably result in his resignation as part of the deal.
Yeah, so there are two separate investigations. One was the Ethics Committee investigation, which is, I believe, going to result in a fine of $100,000 that he's going to pay based on the charges that he improperly used campaign funds. The other one is, of course, the criminal case based on essentially the same money laundering charge.
Yes, so. And it's the ethics investigation, I think, that he's working on the plea for that's going to result in him paying the fine.
I think they expect.
But if he's pleading guilty to that, then
they expect him to make
hard to get out of the criminal case.
Yeah.
So his resignation throws the whole school board into total chaos. He is a member of the charter wing of the school board, which currently has a 4-3 advantage over the more union friendly wing of the board. So when he leaves, the board is deadlocked 3-3. There have already been a lot of votes that ended 3-3 that they couldn't resolve because he hasn't been able to vote in a lot of them. They're gonna have to. What happens? Do they? Does the superintendent appoint someone temporarily, or there has to be an election? Do we know?
I actually don't know.
I don't remember the last time this happened.
Actually imagine that there would be a special election, but I'm not positive.
Oh, great. Another election.
Yes.
Another special election.
Right. But this one is really consequential.
Yeah. And we've seen very strong signals from the from some of the unions that represent workers in the school district. Notably, I think it's SEIU, the Service Employees Union. That they're going to take a very hard line in positioning themselves before contract budgeting in the fall. Essentially, this seat has a role to play in terms of what tack the board is going to take in those negotiations. So this could be a very impactful thing. I think we probably would expect to see both sides of the charter union debate sort of dig in.
It's a huge deal.
And and funnel. I mean,
it's the
charter. The money
is
going
to be nuts.
It's going to be astronomical if it is a special election.
And, oh my God. It'll crush the established record with District 3's election that I think something like $10 million went into. It'll explode that record to be the most expensive. We could basically call now, it will be the most expensive school board race in the history of the world.
Are there other special elections coming up, or would it get lumped into, how soon would we have to do this, do you know? Or would it get lumped into
that's
November,
a great question. I don't know who decides. I don't know.
But yeah, that's the other thing, is just like, also again, is it just going to be the same thing that happened the last time there was school board elections, where it seemed like people just didn't show up, and you know, yeah. it just was whoever had time or money, you know, ended up, you know, getting what they wanted. So I'm so worried about school board elections, because it just seems like people do not care enough about our schools in general, and this is it's a really frustrating.
Absolutely. I think this will be really interesting in terms of sort of being like a barometer of the public opinion of where we're at with the school district right now. This has really been a growing sort of battle between the charters and the union wings over the past several election cycles. Ref Rodriguez, although he is on the school board, he didn't get like a landslide victory here.
No.
It was rather a slim margin of victory. It's going to be interesting to see whether or not public opinion has changed about not only the need for reform in the school district, but also like what form that reform should take.
Yep.
So I think that will really be what this comes down to.
We can skip this week our discussion of propositions on the California ballot, except that we have to bury one.
Yep. Yep, we have.
Did we come up with a special theme for that?
This would have been the more appropriate time to use Prop It Like It's Hot, unfortunately.
Yes.
So Proposition 9, which was put on the ballot by a Silicon Valley billionaire, mm-hmm. Tim Draper, of Skype, essentially.
Really what he is a third generation Silicon Valley billionaire. The industry up there has gotten old enough that there's now the grandchildren of the first VC founders, which is when it's that third wild. Generation that really is good.
Yes.
That's when the genes really come together and creates some very cool guys.
Yeah. The truly civically minded.
Yes.
Very well put together, children and grandchildren.
Yes.
Billionaires. So basically, he put this measure on the ballot that just briefly was going to split California into three states, California, Northern California, and Southern California. He's tried to do this in the past. He wanted to split
different numbers of states.
Yeah, he just, you know, he rolls a dice, Yahtzee and all the rest. He wanted to split California into six states. His big thing is that he doesn't think that the state can be managed in its current form. So the previous one didn't actually make it onto the ballot. This one did, to split it into three states. And essentially what it would have done is it would have signaled that the state population wanted to split the state into three, right? But they couldn't actually do that.
Right.
They would actually need the legislature to then vote to do that, and then Congress to approve it, and then it to be ratified. And that was a very long process that had 0% chance of ever actually happening.
Yes.
But it actually now will no longer even be on the ballot, because the state Supreme Court said that there were too many questions about the constitutionality of the ballot measure, specifically with respect to the state constitution, and they ordered that the Secretary of State, Alex Padilla, take it off the ballot. Tim Draper freaked out, of course, but
yes.
No one really cares about him. He'll come back in a few years with another random number of Californias.
5.5.
But he spent about $5 million getting this message out there that he probably could have done in like a good Medium post.
Yeah. More ballot measures just need to be a really
right?
high
just
traffic
really
Medium post.
Persuasive Medium post.
I mean, is anybody upset about this? Like that this is,
you know what?
A non-billionaire. Silicon Valley third generation billionaire.
I bet there's a lot of support up in like Redding and like northern California,
northern California
that actively wants to secede from California. They would still be attached to
there's that whole Jefferson state of Jefferson.
That's right.
Yeah. So that was going to be one of the six.
Right. Yeah.
So that's what I think they really want to.
So that still might happen. From, you know,
that one got even less support.
Yeah.
Honestly, it's interesting because, yeah, the way that he split up the three Californias, there would not be like, yeah, the state of Jefferson, the super basically libertarian state south of Oregon that a bunch of the red districts up there want.
Yeah.
That's very sparsely populated part of the state. And so by lumping it in with the San Francisco Bay Area.
It still would have been a blue state. It would have done nothing for them. The red state would have been Southern California.
Yeah, we would have been part of...
We would have been part of California.
Yeah, we would have been... Exactly. We would have been lumped into this California. I think Southern California would be OC, San Diego, and the Inland Empire.
Yeah, right? Riverside, San Bernardino. Yeah.
That's still a safe blue state.
I don't think so.
LA County is... 10 million people.
No. That was California.
We would not be Southern California.
Oh, Southern California.
Yeah. It'd be like LA, Santa Barbara.
Not to be confused with Southern California. We're talking about Southern California.
I kind of selfishly, when the maps first came out, I totally forgot about that. I was like, yeah, that would be great, because then we could just charge Orange County and San Bernardino and Riverside residents, in like the way New York charges New Jersey residents income tax if they work in New York City. Sorry.
So you were excited, is what you're saying.
I was a no vote.
So that one was which, just so we can remember to erase
that
the,
was nine.
Prop nine.
Yeah.
Everybody take out your scorecards. Yeah.
Nine. Draw a line through nine.
Nine is off the list.
Take out your lawn signs. Yeah. Pull them out.
Scott, you posted an article earlier this week on Streets blog about how the Trump administration is slow walking funding that has been allocated for the Purple Line extension. We talked about this in the past, about how the city has been, Mayor Garcetti has been fighting to get federal money for these big transit projects. He got it kind of just before Obama went out the door, so it's on the books. But the Trump administration and Elaine Chao, Secretary of Transportation, is not giving it up.
Yeah. Just to clarify, I posted it on Twitter. I didn't write it, the article. Angie Schmidt of Streets Blog, who's excellent, wrote this article about what has been, I think, sort of a known issue that concern is kind of growing over in particularly circles where people pay attention to mass transportation. And that issue is that the Department of Transportation under Trump's administration has proven to be extremely hostile to the notion of spending federal money on transit projects. The federal government has never, well, not in the last several decades, spent a lot of money on these types of rail and bus infrastructure projects, but still, actually, it has gotten much more hostile during Donald Trump's term. Elaine Chao, who is the Secretary of Transportation, wife of Mitch McConnell, basically has a philosophical opposition to mass transportation and has been slowing down the pace of actually extending funds that have been approved already by Congress to the cities that were awarded those funds. So what I was saying on Twitter is that as somebody who actually follows LA transportation projects, the Purple Line, which is being built in three phases from K-Town to Beverly Hills to Westwood, two of the sections have received full funding approval from the federal government. Mm-hmm. The third phase, which goes from Century City to Westwood, has not so far. And it's been waiting on it for quite a while at this point, a year and a half, 2 years, where there actually hasn't been anything holding that up necessarily. So LA Metro is waiting on approvals that would let it start construction, that will tell it how much funding it can expect to actually receive from the federal government. And none of those things are apparently at this point forthcoming. We've been expecting it, I think, since last summer. We've been expecting the decision sort of any day now, and it hasn't happened. So obviously that is a cornerstone of Measure M. It's a cornerstone of the mayor's Olympic dreams.
Yes, this is a great segue.
But at the moment, you know, there's not any indication that the federal government cares about actually pushing this funding through. And this is one of many projects across the country where funds are approved by Congress. Elaine Chao's Department of Transportation is not actually releasing those funds.
And the mayor has kind of spoken up to say, like, excuse me, we were hoping to do this in time for the Olympics that we're all so excited about. And they do not care.
They don't care. Mayor Garcetti actually went very soon after Trump took office last year and spoke to him about the Olympics. They're coming. It's going to be great. And we need federal money to help do this. And Donald Trump, as he often does, said, oh, yeah, I'm totally on board. I want to support, you know, the Olympics coming to America. But his actions totally.
He probably thought it was an event, like a train jump. You launch a train off a ramp into the ocean.
I sort of imagine him being like the, I guess, watching Succession on HBO with an old businessman.
No, I'm afraid not. God,
just, I thought that, I was disappointed. I thought that show was going to be about California, like,
Succession. Yeah.
Anyway, the like Rupert Murdoch-esque CEO just peeing on the floor of his own office because he has no idea where he is. That's kind of what I imagine Garcetti's
happened during that meeting.
But that's what I wonder about this whole thing. We've been waiting for Infrastructure Week.
Yes.
We've been waiting for this big announcement of this big infrastructure plan. I mean, some things are said, but nothing ever for real. And then you look at the fact that a lot of these positions aren't filled in this cabinet department across, you know, the administration. And you just have to wonder if they're doing it on purpose and if they're looking through and being like, Los Angeles, no, like if they have a list or if they honestly cannot get their shit together. And I do not know. I cannot tell. And I do not know, because even when there are communications with us, I used to get a lot of information from the DOT,
and now
the press releases are very strange and sparse. And I just wonder if they honestly maybe like lost the paperwork. I just could see that happening. I honestly could.
I think it is a mix of both. There might be more sort of like blue state cities that are trying to get this kind of funding, but there are definitely red state cities that are doing it as well, and they've been having the same exact issues in actually getting the funds that they were promised. Angie Schmidt brings up that Elaine Chao is a Heritage Foundation alum.
Yep.
So there is a,
if there's anything the Heritage Foundation hates, it's light rail, like trains of all kinds.
So I think at some level it is probably ideological.
Yep.
And Trump has put in his budgets that he wants to cut the programs that actually fund these things. So on some level, it's ideological. I would not be surprised if there's a heavy dose of incompetence sprinkled in there.
Good lesson for the mayor that sweet-talking the president gets you nothing.
Yep.
Like criticizing the president, you are never punished for it. Like it just, there are no consequences for a mayor of a big city to speak out strongly about the administration. Every other mayor is doing this.
This is a good test for him, and he's got this coalition of these climate mayors and these other like transportation mayors that are going to get together and buy, you know, all these EVs to defy Trump's, you know, fossil fuel obsession. So this is a really good test now that this news is out. And now that it's kind of maybe confirmed that this is what's happening, he's going to have to take a big stand here.
Yeah. I think. You love the climate mayors.
We'll be looking for
them. You have like a deck of cards with each of the of the climate mayors and like superhero.
I have them spread up on a wall, and sometimes I put X's over their faces, actually. Not many left up there.
We want to talk about a great series at Curbed. Oh, Alyssa, you're here. This is such a great coincidence.
Now I understand.
You can talk about this. They're doing a series. You're doing a series on the Olympics in 2028. It's great. There's so much good stuff. Is it done, or are you still coming out with more?
Well, what we did was July 21st, 2028 is going to be the first day of the Olympics.
God.
10 years away. The Olympics are now 10 years away. So we have seen some conversation. There's some stuff in the news this week, which we can talk about how the city is hiring this like tourism, or putting an RFP out for this tourism consultant, I guess.
To solve homelessness. Or at least package homelessness.
Yeah, just make sure that it's not too scary for anyone who's going to come here in 10 years for people. But I think there's a lot of excitement maybe about us winning. There's also a lot of people who are really concerned about the fact that the Olympics are coming here, and we just didn't see a whole lot of people, a place where, you know, a lot of stories were collected in one place, or were a place where people could talk about their concerns, or just a place to, you know, tell us what you, where you want, what we also would love for people to tell us what they want to hear about. And yeah, I'm assuming this series will continue for the next decade when we're
I guess you shouldn't stop talking about
over the next 10 years. Now. I'll just keep, but you'll, we'll have them all in the same little, you know, link, and you can look at all the stories we've written about the Olympics. But yeah, for us, it was just, I am obsessed with the 84 Olympics and the amazing design that they brought to the city, and the fact they didn't use, they didn't build any venues and they used what they had. And it's a different kind of story this time. So we were looking back at 84 at what worked, what didn't, hopefully highlighting some things that the city could maybe look at looking forward. Hopefully they are. And some things that we're hoping that could be improved upon.
Let's talk about one article that you wrote. I'm going to use as a backdrop for you, you talking about this. Yeah. A song that you sent me from the official music of the 1984 Games, which I assume you've been listening to exclusively.
I mean, yeah, that's all I listen to for the next 10 years. That's all I'm going to listen to.
This is a song by Toto called Mudito.
I mean, I guess. I don't. I'm. You don't have know. To ask Toto. Yeah, okay. You have to ask.
You wrote a story about transit and the 1984 Olympics and how they basically temporarily solved traffic in LA.
Yes.
And that's what everyone said. Every time you hear people talk about the 84 Olympics, they say, oh, the traffic was amazing. You could get anywhere in 20 minutes.
Well, that was the big. There's no words to this song. I just want you to know. So it's the perfect one that you picked because we can just talk over it. And our drive time commentary. So yeah, everyone said, if you talk to people about the 84 Olympics, they said everybody left town because that's the only way you could have possibly explained the fact that there was no traffic. But actually, as I started to dig into the topic, and there's all these people who worked really hard on making sure that traffic wasn't completely gridlocked the entire time, there were more cars traveling on the freeways during certain points, but it didn't feel like it was trafficky or congested because the way the cars were moving through the city was spread out more through the day. They didn't
that
have
blew
a peak.
My mind.
Yeah, there wasn't these like peaks where you have like, you know, sig alerts and stuff like that. So, and what was amazing was the whole reason that they came up with this very detailed plan to move people around using buses and all these other things we can talk about, all these other great solutions, and compared with a very amazing initiative to get people to work from home or just think about getting to work a different way or carpooling, things like this. It only came about because the PR people who were in the room with the, you know, organizing committee and who else, whoever else, was like, what do we say if an athlete gets stuck in traffic and misses their event?
Wow.
That's the only prompt for how they decided they needed to come up with this transportation plan. So
that's what they were most worried about.
Yeah, it works backwards from, you know.
Because most of them were staying at UCLA then?
Yeah, the Olympic Village was in Westwood. And for example, one of the biggest days that they were worried about, what they had dubbed Black Friday, where they were so worried about two different very large events happening at the Coliseum at the same time where people, you know, morning and afternoon or something like that, where they had to dump the whole Coliseum out of people, then a new group of people had to go to the Coliseum. Plus things were happening at like Dodger Stadium, downtown, you know, Swim Stadium, like all in the same area. So they kind of worked backwards, looking at first, how do we make sure no athletes get stuck in traffic? But then using the capacity of that one day, this Black Friday, and building out an entire, I like to call it a micro transit, you know, network, temporary micro transit network that got everybody around, and everybody loved riding the bus, and everybody had a really great time.
And they're experimenting with doing similar things now, doing another microtransit network for the 28 games.
I mean, by then, who knows?
Who knows?
We can plan, you know. My idea was to even go further and just close all the streets within this very easy kind of grid in the downtown area and just let people walk and bike to a lot of the events, which would make so much more sense.
Oh my
God.
That would be so
Ciclovia
nice.
All the time, every day.
For two weeks.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'd live there.
Well, you get swept off the streets because they don't want people.
Let's talk about that.
Yeah. Let's talk about that.
I do want to play real fast. One of the PSAs that they did.
Oh, yeah. So this was the other really amazing part. I mean, you have to think in 84, we did have the RTD, which was the predecessor to Metro. But I mean, you might know more a lot about like ridership in the 80s and stuff. And why? I mean, it was a very robust, you know, bus network. But we think about it. We didn't have rail. We were actually between rail networks for the Olympics. In 1932, we had rail to get to the Olympics the first time we had it, which is so funny.
Wow. Yep.
Serving our the LA Memorial Coliseum, which was built for the 1932 Olympics. And our most transit accessible stadium to this day.
Yeah.
the RTD was pretty much what people had to get around on for the 1984 Olympics. Ridership was, I think Laura Nelson has covered the Metro ridership beat better than anybody. And
At the LA Times.
And she has noted several times that ridership has basically been falling since about the early 1980s, mm-hmm. or it hasn't exceeded its peak that it achieved then. It's important to note that the Olympics themselves, although I think 1984 was the high watermark for the system ridership, that the Olympics didn't make a huge dent in that. The biggest factor in that was the Proposition A sales tax that we passed in 1980, which actually subsidized fares for like the 3 years following implementation. So
and then they went back up.
And then they went back up and ridership went back down. So, you know, surprise. But yeah. So the Olympics, it was an interesting thing that happened. We had this businessman, Uberoth, can't remember his first name.
Peter
Uberoth, who, you know, he's going to run the Olympics like a business. And he did that and everybody was really happy with him. One of the things that he did, one of the super 80s businessman things that he did was he went and told the RTD, I need enough bus service to handle 1 million people a day, which was significantly more than they were offering. And then they were like, oh, okay, how are you going to pay for that? And he was like, I'm not, you're going to pay for it. And so they did. And the RTD became the only agency in all of LA to take a loss on the 1984 Olympics because they got stiffed by by the Olympic bid committee. So they lost $4 million.
Whoa.
And one thing that was super interesting, which I'm sure will happen again because it's LA, is they had set all the ridership goals and capacity for the understanding that every single event would be booked solid, would every ticket would get sold and everybody would go. And in the report you read, it was like, we didn't expect there to be so many no-shows at the venues themselves.
Yeah,
like people who had tickets, and they, you know, it's hard to tell who to blame or if it was locals or people visiting, but basically ridership was lower and they had fare collection. You know, they did, it just cost a little bit of money, not a lot, for people to use the buses and stuff. But, and it, you know, they were, the schedules were sent as part of your tickets and they really tried to show people to use it. But it wasn't that they weren't riding. It was that people just didn't go.
Right. Wow.
So that's all. I don't know how you prevent that from happening.
How you plan for it.
Yeah, is that the LA way? I don't know.
Classic
LA
thing.
That's so people, some, a big challenge for 2028. I don't know. Maybe
I'm
like,
going to this, I don't know, this swimming heat across town at 5 p.m. and then at 4 you're just like,
maybe they were worried. Maybe they hadn't heard the PSAs and they didn't know and they were too worried about traffic. Because I think the fear about traffic was something they really had to overcome.
Yeah, so City of LA or some organ, maybe the Olympics.
I think it was RTD working with the Olympics organizing committee.
They got some of the hottest celebrities on the planet at the time. Ed McMahon, Monty Hall, Phyllis Diller, and others to record PSA saying, please take transit to the games.
Monty Hall drop a Let's Make a Deal.
He did. He said, do I have a deal for you?
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And he said, really
door number three, zonk, that's traffic. this is Lou Rawls's.
Hey, I'm Lou Rawls. And you know, the Olympic Games are fast approaching. And you hear a lot about the Olympic spirit in the weeks to come. But you know, it's more than just gold medals and national pride. It's a spirit of international cooperation and understanding. And we all can play a part in Olympic history by showing the world how helpful and friendly our city can really be. Now remember, the Olympic Games only last for 2 weeks, but our friendship, hey, it'll last forever.
Yeah,
Lou
baby.
Rawls.
All right. So yeah, making it seem like your civic responsibility was to not get in a car or take the bus. I mean, to me, this just resonated. Once I had learned about it, I did all the research. I was so excited. I was like, well, surely this could be something we could start to do now. You know, in the lead up to the Olympics, we have 10 years. Based on some of the stuff we talked about in other episodes about climate change and emissions.
Yeah.
And I found this study by someone who was at the UC Irvine that basically looked at the results of the Olympic test of eliminating traffic and basically concluded that this could never happen unless there was something like the Olympics. Oh. And that by the end of the Olympics, people started to figure out that traffic was actually, yeah, you know, fine, and they could drive, they could start driving.
Yeah, it's kind of like the Carmageddon thing.
Right? Exactly. Where they did the exact same thing. Right. So I didn't know they did this in 84, yeah, but I remember when they had Eric Estrada do commercials in his freaking whole Chips out. asking people to stay off the roads on Carmageddon, and of course, famously, that was one of the best traffic days in history.
It worked well.
The psychological element is like you take. Everybody knows LA traffic is terrible, and that if you get in a car, you will be miserable. And then you really loudly tell them it can get worse, and it will, and it will get worse. And then everybody gets freaked out and stays home, I guess.
But we but should just do that every day.
Only if it's temporary. Only if it's temporary.
Yeah, right. I mean, all the conclusions about working from home or flexing hours, and some things did come out of it. Like some government offices in departments in LA now do like, you know, every other Friday you stay home, work from home or something like that. And those things do make a really big difference and could maybe make an even bigger difference if there was some type of incentive from the city perspective, which they're... I don't think there really is any kind of concerted effort to flex people's hours. So we'll look for that over the next 10 years as we, you know, eliminate cars.
Let's talk about, there was an article by Jenna Chandler in the series, and it's great, about some of the really negative effects of the 84 Olympics. I know the people from the No Olympics campaign, who we're going to talk to at some point, have really been outspoken about what the effects on the homeless community in 84, Daryl Gates was chief of the LAPD at the time, basically swept as many people off the street as possible in really forcible ways. And they kind of draw a line from what happened in 84 to the riots of 92, which before No Olympics came along, this is a local organization that is
actually
fighting.
Not. They're like a local group of like a national or international type. Okay. No Olympics like everywhere.
Okay. Yeah, so, they're the people here are trying to fight the Olympics from coming here. And I had never made that connection before, but it's very compelling. And this article kind of explains what happened.
You can talk Jenna, about it a little more. Jenna's the editor of Curbed LA. And this was part of this conversation that we had. We had heard again, all these, you know, urban legends, if you will, like the one about the traffic. And then the other one was that the reason that the uprising happened in 92 was because the police was so over militarized from the Olympics. They had gotten all these, you know, insane tools from
armored
the federal
tanks.
Government. Yeah. Toys, maybe you might call them. And there's these pictures of them, you know, rolling into the Olympics and saying like, oh, we're, you know, protecting the city and look how well armed we are. And there was reason, you know, for them to be worried about terrorism because Munich had just happened. If everybody has seen the movie, you know that there was a terrorism situation where athletes were killed in the Olympic Village. So there was a lot of concern about that. But what Jenna, you know, Jenna is an amazing reporter and, you know, went down and found a lot of these documents. Some really appalling things were said, like on the floor of the city council, for example, about what they wanted to do to keep people in line. And, you know,
well, council member Gilbert Lindsay wanted to resurrect the city drunk farm.
Yeah. Sending people. Yeah.
Taking homeless people with addiction issues and putting them on this farm in the Saugus, where they would be sharecroppers, essentially.
Yeah.
This is in 1983.
Yeah.
I mean, it's unbelievable the kind of stuff that they tried. They didn't do that.
And one of the commanders, like said, we're going to sterilize the streets. I mean, that was his quote too about it. So you heard kind of this rhetoric that was very terrifying, and a lot of, you know, a lot of armored vehicles, you know, rolling into town. Obviously nothing really bad happened during the Olympics as far as, you know, a violent episode but we were worried about, you know, what happened to these communities that were basically swept off the streets or, apparently there was like a lot of sex workers that had been involved in this crackdown. They arrested like 1,000 people in the weeks before the Olympics. And then there was a quote from an LA Times article that was someone who was homeless who has just said they didn't used to bother us, but now it's really bad. Like they're really trying to come after us. So Jenna talked to a lot of people who kind of looked at those parallels, like you said, from not just the militarization and all the horrible toys that they ended up driving through some home and it's some like weed bust later.
But they ended up with like a little baggie of weed. Right?
But that, you know, there, some of these things are starting to happen again now. You hear some of the same conversations being brought up about where people are allowed to sleep and how do we make sure to keep people out of view, which was part of this RFP that went out for this tourism consultant to try to make sure that, you know, people aren't afraid of walking around in downtown areas where there are homeless people or something, you know. So
in this article, she talks about how in 1982... the city passed a law barring people from sleeping in their cars on the streets. 6 months before the games, they banned sleeping on bus benches. Sleeping on the sidewalk was already illegal at that time, I believe. These are all things that we're watching play out now. Some of them have already happened with the illegalizing sleeping in cars and benches. And the mayor, as Jenna points out, has talked about enforcing laws about sleeping on the sidewalk. So 10 years ahead.
Yep.
I mean,
I was going to say, so this isn't like a year prior to the Olympics.
No,
this is with a lot of lead time, which actually really increases the amount of potentially damaging policy that could be in place and carried out before the Olympics actually show
up.
I mean, to me, the question always comes back to what do public officials, perceive as the goal of actually bringing the Olympics here, and then essentially like what are they willing to do to achieve those goals. If I mean, as you know, it's one thing to have Lou Rawls say like the goal of the Olympics is, you know, this
spirit
of friendship, and like, listen, I love Lou Rawls, that's great, but the reality is that from the city's perspective, from Eric Garcetti's perspective, from all of the civic boosters who have worked very hard to get the Olympics to come back here, there is a distinct goal. A lot of them are personal goals in terms of actually like building political capital and furthering individual careers. Others are specifically about changing, Alyssa, as you mentioned, maybe changing the way that people view LA nationally, changing the way that they view American municipal leadership nationally. And what that entails is potentially pretty wide ranging. And we can see that they are willing to do things that I think a lot of Angelenos, if they actually considered them in a vacuum, would not be okay with.
Yeah.
And it's somewhat troubling. I think to hear basically the rhetoric of the willingness to go back to actually criminalizing people for existing on the street. If we talk about the need to increase cooperation with the federal law enforcement structures, that's something that I think at this particular moment in time, a lot of people would be opposed to who live in Los Angeles. And it has a lot of implications for people that are not deeply embedded in the decision-making structure of the city.
I think this article is really interesting in combination with one by Patrick Sisson. He wrote a piece about basically the potential for the Olympics to raise the cost of real estate in LA. There have been a ton of studies recently about how a 5% increase in rent, the cost of rent, is associated with several thousand additional people becoming homeless.
Right.
So the Olympics could potentially put more people onto the street in the 10 years leading up to the games, and further criminalization of those people.
I mean, you're going to need a lot of drunk farms, I think.
Man.
I mean, you're just going to have to build these communities out in the desert, and we're all going to have to move to them because we're all going to be displaced.
Yes.
So, no, but I think... Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. No, you go ahead.
I think that two things are really sticking out to me and kind of concerning to me after we did this series. One is what you just said. It's kind of like, yes, we can try to convince people to do good things, like you know, not get in their car maybe or carpool because it's just the games. And then two is we can also try to push some pretty troubling things onto the public just because it's the games or whatever. So I think you're going to start to hear a lot of these things. This tourism thing this week really rattled me because I feel like it's just a bad look to say we need to fix this for the Olympics, you know, and they're probably scared because in San Francisco there was this major convention that said it wasn't coming back to the city. We don't even really know. I mean, those things are planned so far out anyway. Who knows like when they decided or whatever. But I think that now other cities are probably scared because they could see that they're losing out on that big convention money if they don't, you know, get their act together. But this is the absolute wrong way to start thinking about it. And the fact that even we didn't hear from anyone else in the city government that what they actually want to do with this or, you know, all the comments were pretty tone deaf to me. Like it just didn't seem like they were putting those things together.
At the same time, the city has made a lot of pushes to build housing infrastructure and that kind of thing. If they could tie that to the Olympics and basically say we could produce enough housing in this county to solve homelessness by 2028,
and
which is true.
Yeah, there's 28 by 28, the metro projects or other transportation projects that the mayor has made this list of, which do not include nearly enough biking and walking improvements, for example, which we desperately need. But why not do some 28 by 28 for solar goals, energy, any energy savings, water goals? Yeah. You know, let's do this all across and make housing part of it.
We want to talk about, obviously, Jonathan Gold passed away yesterday. He's being memorialized all over the city, all over the internet. The thing that you hear over and over and over again that I know is the case for me, I saw you say the exact same thing, Alyssa. Scott, you were born here, but you left and came back. I imagine you had a similar situation. When you first show up, what you do is someone gives you a copy of Counterintelligence. My now wife was here a year before me, and she had it waiting in like my gift basket. And they say, read this. This will help you navigate the city. Your roommate gave it to you,
Alyssa? My roommate gave it to me 17 years ago,
Yeah. And I know people now, they go through the gold list, the formerly gold 99, now the gold 101. Yes. and numbers. They check off as many as they can. You see all different neighborhoods of the city. It's how people discover it. He was so important to locals and newcomers. He was one of the most welcoming presences in a city that now I think is grappling with how many new people that it can take in. And I think he was a voice for bringing in as many people as possible. And he was someone that everyone totally felt like they knew. You did know him, Alyssa.
I did. The first thing I would recommend to anybody, maybe if Counterintelligence, still read it because the writing is amazing and the restaurants, most of them are still there and still great and still serving meals. But, you know, maybe look at one of the updated lists. But there's another great primer on him and his work. And that's a documentary called City of Gold, which came out a couple years ago. And I saw it when I, you know, got to also go see him in this big celebration of, it was a party at like Grand Central Market. And then we went next door to the Million Dollar Theater and watched the movie. And there was, everybody was there. And then he did a panel on stage after. It was just like, it was just the most LA night possible. And all the people who were in these restaurants, like all who own these restaurants, all these immigrant families who had come here and had started these restaurants were all there too. And it was just this very LA night, and I walked out of there just being like, that's the best movie that's ever been made about LA.
Yeah,
because it really just seemed
really, really good.
It really seemed to get it. It really seemed to get us, and as he did, in a way that was not about stereotypes and you know, all the other things that people try to tell you about LA. And he talks about that in the movie as well.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the thing for me that was always so funny about my interactions with Jonathan and like how we at first like met was, you know, I started writing about things like urbanism and transportation, and he always felt so ashamed that he drove a car.
He did. Now, he did just drive a car.
He drove a giant, like crazy, like Dodge Ram. I think it was like a very like, and you would always like know he was coming because it was like rattling down the road. And he was so, I mean, it's so funny to read some of the remembrances of him, because everybody had such similar experiences. Like, he was super hard to pin down and actually like go somewhere with, because he was always kind of doing something or wouldn't call you back or whatever. But then, you know, once you got to hang out with him, it was so worth it. And you would get the ride home in the truck or whatever, you know, as part of the meal. But he was always saying to me, you know, how guilty he felt. And he even said about the movies, like, I just feel so bad. I was thinking the whole time, like, I'm driving all over the city. Of course, I forgive him, because he had to get to some places in the city.
And he's on the bus sometimes.
Well, that was the thing, too. And the thing that I think people don't know, maybe what I wanted to also mention was he had like several lives and several careers before he became a super famous food critic. And he wrote beautifully about music. And he, you know, was like an art student who did all these crazy performance art, you know, performances. So his brother, I should mention, is an environmentalist who is, you know, really added like a depth to what he thought about and brought issues that he brought forth in the city when it comes to like sustainability and food. So we have to really look at him as an entire Renaissance man. I hate saying that exact thing, because I feel like people say that about a lot of people, but he really could do it all. He could write about anything. He knew about everything. And there wasn't a day that went by that I wasn't looking at Twitter to see what he thought about, you know, every single thing that happened.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
And yes, he did used to ride the bus around a lot, and, you know, he has street cred. It's all
good. I didn't know him personally, but he wrote like somebody who had a deep love and respect for people of all different backgrounds. And, I don't even actually remember the way that I was introduced to his writing, but it's just like very characteristic of LA that the city has this reputation of being so fragmented, so disjointed, and a place where you can arrive and just like not really be welcomed. Like you're greeted very obliquely, and there's not like,
it's hard to orient yourself when you first show.
Yeah, yeah. And so Jonathan Gold was this person that would really just like embrace all of the different aspects of what composed LA, you know, and including the people that came here from all over the world for all kinds of different reasons. And for that reason, he was really amazing at writing about food. But like you were saying, Alyssa, he could write really amazing pieces about so many different topics. And the like essential humility of the things that he wrote, like especially food criticism, I feel like is such a genre where you encounter people that are telling you like what you have to care about and why. Mm-hmm. And like it's all like super didactic and pretentious, and he cut through that better than I feel like anybody that I ever read write about food. And really like tied, I don't know, just like so many disparate threads about LA together into something that really makes cohesive, coherent sense to a lot of people. And I think that that is proven by the response that,
passing
is getting online. I mean, one other thing that people might not know who weren't, you know, in the food writing or journalism industry is that it was traditional for food critics to be anonymous, and mm-hmm. people would even go to great efforts to wear disguises so people wouldn't recognize you. And he, I don't know how you say it, he like renounced his anonymity or something.
Sure.
I don't
Which
know.
He didn't like... have to begin with.
Right.
He was an extremely distinctive looking person, and right. everybody knew what he looked
but
like.
But the argument is probably if you run a restaurant, you would probably know who the food critics are anyway, even if you didn't look like Jonathan Gold, this amazing, you know, vibrant person. But I think it was such an amazing thing for him to do at that moment in time, because of some of the issues I was talking about around sustainability and food justice and making sure that these immigrant families that were, you know, opening these restaurants felt in a way like they were validated and protected. So he did a very brave and very controversial thing in the food writing world, but it completely changed the conversation around why we write about food and who benefits mm-hmm. and who are we doing this for. And I would love to see more critics actually follow his lead, maybe his passing will make more people realize that it's not about getting the best service at a Michelin star restaurant anymore.
Yeah. He got me to try an Okie dog, which is one of the most disgusting things I've ever eaten in my life. It's two hot dogs wrapped in a burrito surrounded by chili and cheese. But he writes about it as something that he ate when he was part of like the grimy LA punk scene of the 70s. That was wonderful. I wanted to read something I found. He used to have a column in LA Weekly where people would write him letters. And he has a letter from 2010 where he plans a menu for his own funeral, which I think is a really beautiful encapsulation of sort of who he was. And so the letter writer says, "Dear Mr. Gold, I hope you're in good health, but if the N were near, which restaurant would you let cater your funeral?" And then it says, it's hopefully Chinese in parentheses. And Jonathan Gold says, "Preferably Chinese. My corpse isn't cold yet, and you're already dictating what will be served at the funeral. My living room is pretty big, but it's going to get crowded with all the dim sum carts rolling through it. And then there's the eternal dilemma of whether there are enough Ophalians, which is the people that eat offal, which is like innards, which is something he ate a huge amount of. There are enough Ophalians around to warrant getting the blood cubes or the steamed bowels, whether the sesame balls have been out too long out of the fryer, and whether the woman pushing the hamper of dufu fa has already run out of syrup. These are the questions that will haunt me in my grave, I fear. Also, if the food is really good, I'm going to regret having died in the first place. A big array of Chinese cold dishes might work better. Chang's Garden for Shanghainese, or Shu Feng Wan for chili red Sichuan, or an endless table heaped with Korean banchan. From banchan a la carte up on Western, why not? The nicest and saddest funeral I ever attended was accompanied by a half ton of meza from Marouche. But who am I kidding? In my family, funerals are occasions to stuff down truly heroic amounts of deli, and when I have to go, I will die as I lived, seen off with Langer's pastrami." Just the truly the greatest guy, the best to ever do the job that he did, the greatest spokesman for LA. No one will ever replace him. Thank you for listening to the show. We'll be back next week. Thank you, Alyssa, for joining us again. I'm sorry to do that to you.
Just go to Langer's, get some pastrami.
Get the number 19, I think.
You gotta go get some pastrami, and you'll be okay.
We'll be back next week on LA Podcast.